ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Justin Wolfers is an Australian economist who spent 6 years with the Reserve Bank in the mid-90s, and he's now spent 25 years in the United States, where he's currently Professor of Public Policy and Economics at the University of Michigan. He's also started his own website and podcast called Platypus Economics, and has become one of the best-known economics communicators in the United States, providing very sharp insights into the US and global economies. I spoke to him this week from Cape Cod, where he's holidaying with his family. And we covered a big range of topics, including the health of the global economy, the US economy, tariffs, immigration, jobs, the Federal Reserve, climate change, and the marriage of Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. So here's Justin Wolfers, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Well, Justin, you seem to have not got the invitation to Taylor Swift's wedding at Madison Square Garden, so I don't know what happened there.
How would you know, Alan? The guest list is secret, and I will tell you that those of us who were there are not allowed to say whether we were or not.
Oh, I see, right.
Yeah.
But look, seriously, what do you think that event says about the current state of America, about the power of celebrity and wealth particularly, and how that's being expressed in politics?
I am going to answer you in the most roundabout possible way and just say, isn't it nice to know that love is alive? If you spent your days over here, you might spend a fair bit of your time thinking about doom and gloom and all the things that go wrong, and that one of the most talented artists of her generation has found true love and found it her way. I actually went to the Taylor Swift concert at the Sydney Cricket Ground.
Oh, right.
Not that long ago. So I waved to Taylor then. So it's almost like we're close.
A lot of Australians who go and live in the United States, like you, kind of become American. They sound American and all this. And you haven't done that. You very much still an Aussie. And you play it up a bit with your website and podcast called Platypus Economics. Does being an Australian as an outsider help you see the US economy a bit more clearly than those insiders who are there?
Yeah, I think it does. It's a weird thing. So, you know, I'll tell you, Alan, the truth is, as an economist, I do a lot of interviews, including like this, and people ask me things and I just answer. And then people are like, oh, we really liked your directness. And I'm like, I wasn't being direct, I was just answering. And then sometimes people say, and this baffles me, I'm not trying to talk myself up, they say, you're really funny. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm an economics professor. I'm the opposite of funny. And I think it is that we do have a more direct way of seeing the world. The other thing is the US is in an absurd moment. And if you're truly on the inside, you may not be able to see the absurdity. So I think there's the outsider status, let's just see the absurdity. We have a directness. And then honestly, when people say I'm funny, I realize that the only thing I do that's funny is I arrange facts one after the other after the other. And the fact is our current reality is one that if you actually state raw facts in front of people, they will find them funny because there is profound absurdity to everything that's going on. So, you know, I also just want to qualify the answer slightly and say I have got my accent, but I have spent enough time over here. Every time I go back to Australia, I suddenly learn that I'm actually a little bit more culturally American than I realized.
You do seem to be having fun, though. I mean, you must strike them as being not your typical professor of economics.
That's not really for me to say. Look, there is a reason. Look, the truth is I'm an economics professor. Beyond that, you and I are both in front of a camera right now. We each get to decide what parts of ourselves to show. You've shown that distinguished-looking cardigan, which gives you gravitas, and I choose to show my Australianness. Partly there is something lightly strategic about that. You want to be a little bit memorable. The Americans love Australia. They love Australians. They forgive us lots of things. So I also get to get away with a lot of things that an American economics professor wouldn't get to get away with. But I find it hard to reflect on myself. So let me give you a different Australian who I think is very interesting for the same reason, is Jonathan Swan, who writes for the New York Times and is now one of the closest followers, political commentators of the president. Jonathan has been, I don't know him. I might have exchanged an email or two, but he's been unbelievably successful. And it really is. He sits there with the president. The president says something stupid, and then he says, "No, really, do you mean that?"
Have you read his book with Maggie Haberman?
I haven't yet. It's got a lot of people talking though, and he's certainly got tremendous access. So very, very successful. We should be proud of him.
On to economics. What's your current diagnosis of the US and global economies?
Look, the US is sucking all the conversational oxygen out of the room, and within the US, it's the present. So there are two ways to describe the current moment. One is if you stand back a bit and just look at the long run of history, we're not in the middle of a war. We're not in the middle of a revolution. We're not in the middle of a banking crisis, a pandemic, a long stagnation. And if you just took those things out of people's lives, economic life generally turns out to be good whenever we're not in one of those dramatic moments. And so we're not in one of those dramatic moments. So in fact, life is pretty good. I want to come back to why it's not in a moment, but I think there's a thing people forget, which is as much as I care deeply about economics and inequality and reducing unemployment and all manner of social ills, people often say, how can you live in the land of Trump? And the reality is what I do every morning is I wake up and I see my kids and they're smiling and then I go get them, I can't get them Weet-Bix, I get them Cheerios and then I send them off to school and I tell them I love them and then I have a coffee with my partner. Now the coffee's not as good because I'm in America and then I might go to a faculty meeting, which those are boring in America and Australia, and then I might write a column, you know. So daily, and then we have dinner. Go for a walk. The reality is our daily lives are not political. They're not deeply politically inflected. Now, when you average across 340 million people, you know, the unemployment rate being up 0.1 percentage point is actually millions of people and hundreds of thousands of stories that really, really matter. So it really does matter. So look, on the one hand, all the terrible exogenous influences, outside influences are not with us. Then there's the other hand. The other hand is the quality of economic policymaking in the United States right now is chaotic. It has thrown out the baby, the bathwater, and it's probably gone and tipped the bucket on a whole bunch of other things as well. And it is frankly low quality. It's the worst, it's the lowest horsepower administration. It's the least organized administration. It's the least willing to do their homework administration. It is ineffective, ineffectual, and when it does have an effect, it's often bad. All of those things come out of my lifetime.
In fact, they're engaged in a big experiment, it seems to me. I mean, and you've been writing about tariffs and jobs a fair bit, but the experiment is they're reducing migration enormously to the point where they've got the lowest participation rate in 50 years. And in fact, the working age population is declining.
Yeah.
And they've reintroduced tariffs at the same time. So, and the Supreme Court struck down a few of them, but not all of them. Take us through how you see the effect of those two things on the economy.
Yeah. So let me be quick on tariffs. And the reason I want to be quick with you, Alan, is because Australians are remarkably sensible and smart on the topic. If your judgment is that I've overstated the brilliance of Australians, let's dwell and spend time on it. But I think Australians understood 40 or 50 years ago the folly of tariffs, and pretty much early Hawke government sort of gave it away. By the way, one of the areas of economics where Australians have made the largest contribution is in international trade theory. We wrote the book. And I think, I don't want to say tariffs are always and everywhere stupid. There are reasonable arguments to be had about whether there are strategic times and places in which one might engage in it. I'm mostly against them, but I also like to represent the economics profession, not myself. And so the economics profession would be willing to admit there's a limited number of circumstances where it's an open question what to do. You know, things like national defense are a really big deal. We saw big trade issues arising during COVID in Australia. But generally speaking, I think Australia's gotten this debate right. We've gotten it right many decades in a row. And there might be a temptation back home to say, well, if the Americans are going to treat us badly, we should treat them badly. But that's an economic mistake.
In fact, you joined the Reserve Bank, I think, when Keating was still Prime Minister, didn't you? I mean, and that would have been formative years for you.
Oh, mate, yes, very much. A very, very young version of me once shook hands with Paul Keating, and I still remember it. Bernie Fraser was the governor of the RBA at the time. The RBA didn't have a lot to do with tariffs, but through that I got to know a generation of Australian economics journalists who I think through those years played a very, very important, powerful role. One could argue whether it's too powerful, but they were certainly very effective. I worry a lot about the quality of our politics back home, because one of the things that drives the quality of our politics is the quality of our journalism. So, Alan, I'm thrilled by your show. I love the industry you're engaged in, which is how can we create a more economically informed population. I want you to understand that's not just the role of teacher. That's a role of political and economic institution. You, by educating Aussies about how to think through these issues, give them the tools they need to keep the bastards honest, to borrow Don Chip's old line. And there are lots of ways of describing why Australia is better or worse than other countries, but the better educated our folks are about understanding these debates, the better will be the quality of our economics. And I think we currently have pretty good economics. There's things we can improve. But I think a lot of that's going to start with an informed population.
Just on tariffs, I mean, do you think that Donald Trump actually believes that other countries pay them rather than American consumers? Or is he just sort of saying an obvious lie, really, because he wants to use the tariffs for geopolitical leverage, which is what he's doing?
The tariffs are overdetermined. But let me start. I want to give you an honest answer to your question, which is, you said, do you think you believe that Donald Trump dot, dot, dot? And I've adopted a policy which I believe in sufficiently. I'm going to explain it to you at the risk of boring you, which is, I don't think it does me any good to try and imagine I know what's going on between the guy's ears. It's unknowable. And if you want to know, ask a psychiatrist, not an economist. The president certainly has acted year after year for many decades in a row as if he believes in tariffs. And then that belief then seems to create an industry of people giving rationales. So you just gave one rationale, which is it gives him leverage. On the campaign trail, it was that it would create revenue. A different argument that he's frequently made is it's actually all about the trade deficit, which is an inanely stupid thing to say. You know, that it is paid for by others. You know, it's one of those arguments.
Did it revive US manufacturing?
This is where I have to ask you whether I'm allowed to swear. This is the ABC, so I'm going to choose not to, but I'm just going to give you a heck no. And in fact, the US, what's actually really quite striking, and I've done some work on this recently, is the president is very much, his whole agenda is very masculine, big, buffy blokes wearing hard hats and steel-toed boots and taking their lunch pails into the factory. That's all of the rhetoric. That's actually none of the jobs. All of the jobs, literally every single job created under the Trump administration has been in healthcare and social assistance. And if you took those jobs out, the rest of the economy is shrinking.
And I guess they're female too, aren't they?
90%. 90% of all jobs created so far under President Trump have been female. So the reality of the American economy doing okay is a reality, and it's substantially at odds with the industrial dreams of the administration, which might lead you to believe that the economy is doing well despite rather than because of the president. The story with tariffs and manufacturing is pretty easy, right? If you put a 50% tariff on aluminium, by the way, can I say what a great joy it is to be able to say aluminium, not aluminum? I'm now bilingual and can say both. You put a 50% tariff on aluminium and a whole lot of manufactured stuff's made out of aluminium. That means the only place in the world where it's expensive to turn aluminium into manufactured goods is the United States. You know, the first rule in the tariff handbook is don't tariff inputs. And he broke that. So let me try and draw, I think, a broader lens on this whole tariff discussion. There's a reasonable argument to be made, not a reasonable, there exists an argument about whether tariffs can sometimes be helpful. There maybe even exists a broader argument about whether tariffs are good, smart tariffs are good. I'm not going to concede either point, but even if I did, those arguments aren't relevant to what this administration is doing. Because what this administration is doing is chaotic, lawless, pointless, poorly targeted tariffs. And there's not a person on earth who thinks that's a good idea.
You've said that the US economy is treading water. At what point does treading water become drowning? And what's the threshold number or combination of indicators that would make you think that?
Yeah, so I try very hard. This is to the audience, not to you, Alan. I think one of the most important skills any of us can have when we think about policy issues is not to think just about the policy issue, but to think through the meta-analytics of, am I biased here? Am I missing things? Am I miscalibrated? Am I cheerleading? So I really don't like the president. That's just the truth. And I think his economic team is stupid. And I think a lot of what they're doing is incredibly destructive. All of that's true. And the United States right now has a 4.2% unemployment rate. And 4.2% is really good. It's good by international standards. It's good by historical standards. And it means that when most people want work, they can find it. So if you were to tread water at a place that's not terrible, you know, that's okay. I really think the issues confronting the United States are much more about one of the things I admire you for, Alan, is you've relentlessly brought it back to productivity. And at the end of the day, productivity is everything. And what are the preconditions for productivity? And they're things like the rule of law, an understanding that market forces will allow the more efficient firm to get ahead rather than the president simply favoring his mates. It's innovation. It's immigration that creates innovation, and on it goes. So those are the issues I'd be much more focused on than, you know, are we treading water this month versus we're getting a little ahead or a little behind. Those are little wiggles on the way. The real question is, where are we going?
Justin, what's your view about AI? Is it will it improve productivity or is it just a bubble?
That's not neither or question. Let me take the interesting half of it, which is, will it improve productivity? The answer is unequivocally yes. I'm a labor economist and I spent much of my career waiting for something interesting to happen. And then one day I woke up and discovered we're in the midst of an industrial revolution. So this is the most important shock to labor markets that I've seen since I became an economist. And I'd like to think I'm young enough that that's not that long, but actually the truth is I'm old enough. That's quite a while. I think the real look, lots of people disagree. There are sometimes good reasons and sometimes bad reasons, but I think what I can say is the consensus of folks who understand the technology well is that this will lead to a revolution in how we structure our lives. And the only real question is at what speed. They tend to think very, very quickly. There are probably pretty good reasons from past technological revolutions to believe that humans move a little slower than our tech overlords want us to believe.
What about the decline in immigration? Is that leading to a situation where all economic growth in the US will have to come from productivity?
Yes and or yes, but I'm not worried about that part. I mean, all growth in per capita GDP in all countries comes from productivity plus a little bit of capital deepening. So that's, let's not play accounting games. Let's actually just take a step back and talk about what I think the big picture is on immigration. I think it's really interesting because the US and Australia are two of the greatest immigration stories in the history of the world. And the US is giving it up. The real story of immigration for immigration is innovation. People who pick up their home life and move across the world in the hopes of a bigger dream, whether they're immigrating to Australia or to the United States, it doesn't seem a stretch to believe that they're more likely to be innovative. And my family was an immigrant to Australia, and over here I'm an immigrant to the United States, and I believe this deeply. And I don't believe it as a matter of political rhetoric. I believe it as a statement about what the data show about innovation. The sense in which the United States is an exceptional economy, a lot of that comes down to innovation, that no other country around the world has Facebook and Google and OpenAI and Anthropic and these just digital powerhouses that
are already dominating our current era and will dominate the next one. Every one of those companies, you know, the Magnificent Seven, has substantial immigrant roots at its core. You know, Steve Jobs was the son of a Syrian immigrant, I think it was, and you can go company by company. And that's U.S. exceptionalism. The other part of U.S. exceptionalism is the reason I'm here. If I were Russell Crowe, if I were an Aussie actor, if I were a great Aussie actor, I'd go to Hollywood. Not because I like the weather in Hollywood, but because that's where the action is. That's the world stage. And I'm an economist, or I'm an academic, and it turns out that the United States is the world stage. And I mean no disrespect to my colleagues and friends back in Australian universities. I mean to state that as just a reality that's obvious within the field, even if it's not obvious outside it. That, though, is not a guarantee. In fact, prior to World War II, Germany was the center of art and innovation and science and social science in the world. And Hitler made Germany a very uncomfortable place for Jews. As a result, German universities and German innovation has never been the same since. And so some place gets to be Hollywood and in and Hollywood for innovation. And that's what the research that's done at universities is all about. That's currently the United States. But at the moment, if someone wants to come and study for a PhD under me, I can't guarantee that the visa they get in on their first year, whether they'll be able to renew it enough times that they'll be able to finish their doctoral studies. Which means that person's thinking to themselves, I need to go and start my career somewhere, but not here. Somewhere where they like me, somewhere where I'll be guaranteed I'm allowed to finish. Somewhere where I'll get some respect, somewhere I'm not taking enormous risks. And so one of the arms of US exceptionalism, Trump is betting a lot on. What's difficult about that conversation is there's a lot of reporters who call me after the latest monthly unemployment report or the quarterly GDP report and say what's happening next month or next quarter. These are things that play out over decades. And the current Trump moment will simply exist in 60 years' time as university departments that are not great, ideas and innovations that were never had, and startups that were never started. They're opportunities that never arise that simply won't be visible because the preconditions for those opportunities were destroyed by Trump.
Paul Ann Hansen's One Nation is now, you know, rising in the polls. I think it's more or less knocking off Labor and certainly the coalition. Do you think Australia's having a Trump moment?
I'm the wrong person to ask. There are Australians who follow politics very closely. And I don't want to dart too far outside my expertise. But what I do want to say is that I think immigration is a big part of what makes and has made Australia. And I mean that economically. I mean it socially. I mean it politically. You know, I've spent enough time in the US that I'm used to sitting in a room now where Americans will say, this is the greatest country in the history of the world. And we're all meant to stand there as if it's obviously true. And I remember back home, if someone said that, you think they're a bit of a wanker. And Australians aren't very good at saying the following, but it's true. Australia is one of the greatest nations in the world. Our economic and political institutions are among the very best in the world. We have a degree of economic stability and economic growth and economic opportunity and inclusion that is the envy of the rest of the world, or it would be if they knew about it. And then I understand many people listening are going to say, oh, come on, who's this wanker that he's saying things like that? We're not serving our poor well. We're not serving the Indigenous well. Inequality is too high. All of those things can be true. I want to concede the full complaint list and then just say, we're still doing better than most. And we have the preconditions to be better than most. So one of the comments I've often made about Trump is a revolutionary figure, not an evolutionary, certainly not conservative in the sense of conserving what made America great. Now, bashing everything down and starting over would be a really good bet if what you have doesn't work. But if what you have does work, then these enormous revolutionary steps, like abolishing immigration, risk the thing that made everything so great. So were I, you know, I vote in both countries, and in both, I would vote for a continuation of what made each of these two of the richest countries in the world.
Just on immigration and innovation, which you've obviously talked about, you've also talked about a brain drain of people leaving America. Does that represent an opportunity for other countries like Australia to pick these people up, to pick up Americans?
Yes.
And increase their own, improve their own innovation?
Yes. Look, many of the world's most talented people are looking for a home. Some of them because they come from poor countries, some of them because they come from unsafe countries, and some of them because they're looking for other smart people to be in the room with. It's a ridiculous irony that at this moment when leadership in global higher education, which is my industry, is up for grabs more than it's ever been, that Australia is starting to turn its back on the market for international education. I think it's one of, let me just tell you at a personal level, my job's terrific. I love my job. I get to sit around and think about something I'm deeply passionate about. I get to try and help change the world. And I never, ever come home with an aching back or with mud under my fingernails, all of which are good, noble jobs. But if you think about what you want for your kids, I reckon I'd like my kids to grow up with the sort of jobs where they get to sit around and think and express themselves and so on. So I would love for Australia's higher education sector to continue to create those incredibly high quality jobs that also help build an innovation culture in Australia. And if Australia can do that by making higher education one of our most important exports, we should dive into it. And we did that for many years, and I think we did it in ways that were at times unsophisticated, and you could fault the vice chancellors involved and all of that. But I don't think at any moment should we walk back from this idea that we'll accept foreigners coming around the world to pay tens of thousands of dollars to Australian universities and then to go home to their home countries inculcated in Australian values with Australian friendships and Australian connections. I think it's such an obvious foundation for economic growth. We would be foolish not to be diving all into it.
Well, one of the things that everyone's debating in Australia is housing affordability. It's been a big political and economic issue here.
Yep.
But it now seems to be a big issue in the US because house prices have surged over the last few years. It happened a bit later in the US because of the big decline in house prices in the GFC in 2007-8. So what's happened there with housing? What's going on?
Yeah, so one thing to understand about the US almost always is America contains multitudes. Sometimes it's better off thought of as 50 different countries who came together the way we think of the EU. Let me describe it instead in terms of two Americas. If you go to a state like Arizona or Texas or Nevada, if you want to build a house, you just put in a housing permit. At the end of the day, they've said yes. And these are cities that just go on forever out into the desert. And so you just buy a block of land and you build a house. What that means is that say it costs $300,000 to build a house, the moment the house price rises to $301,000, someone realizes they could make $1,000 by building a house. That in turn means that the supply of housing is basically infinite at $300,000 in those cities. And so if you want to draw economics diagrams in the air, the supply curve's horizontal. So in those cities, if more people want to move to them, they just build more housing. And there's not a house price boom. And that's true in half America. Because remember, the thing that's different between the US and Australia, Australia's got the four big capital cities and then a bunch of country towns. But it's approximately true. It's precisely wrong and approximately true that all Australians live in a half dozen cities. So the US then has hundreds and hundreds of cities like the town I live in, which is a town of 120,000, with hundreds of them. Of Ballarats, if you want to think of it that way. So that's one America. The other America, though, is the coastal cities in particular, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Boston. The easiest one to think of is to think of New York, which is Manhattan is literally an island. There's no more places to build a house. I mean, you could build up into the air, but actually you can't get the crane down the street to build up in the air anymore. So what that means is in Manhattan, it's not quite literally, but metaphorically impossible to build a house. And what that means is if you've got more people or more demand or more income, everything that increases housing demand leads to higher prices. And so that's the story of Manhattan. But then you can go to other cities like San Francisco, which look a lot like Sydney in the sense that They're on the bay, but there's infinite area that they could grow inland. But what you get is very strong NIMBY politics, where everyone says, yes, I'm in favour of housing, but not in my backyard. And they make it impossible. And there are pockets of Sydney that are exactly like this. I, for better or worse, spend some time in Mossman, and trying to get an approval for housing a unit there is close to impossible. And so those are the cities where essentially the housing stock is fixed. And so as we become a bigger country, a richer city, you get more demand and the same number of apartments and there's not same number of beds. And that's just going to lead to higher housing prices. So that's, in a nutshell, the story of Sydney and Melbourne. And increasingly, it's also the story in the United States of San Francisco and Boston and New York and LA and Portland and Seattle and many, many other cities. Same disease in all of these places, which is it's not always natural blockages that prevent you from building more houses. It's increasingly regulatory blockages that prevent that.
I must say, that's one of the best explanations I've heard of housing affordability. So thanks for that.
Good.
We haven't talked about the Iran war. So obviously the attempt to bomb Iran into giving up its nuclear weapons and also causing a regime change hasn't worked. So what's your view about the longer term impact on the global economy of the of that war, and also and particularly the closure of the Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah. I think the lesson for all countries around the world is before you think about starting a war, think again. And then once you've thought again, think again after that. And then once you've thought again after that, still don't do it. Look, you probably don't need an economist to tell you this, but so many of the historical inflection points about the organization of the global economy, global politics, global strength, those inflection points happen at times of war. And so if things are pretty good, you don't want an inflection point. You want everything to continue. What have we gotten out of this? What has the US gotten out of this? So they began the war when Iran was run by Ayatollah Khamenei. Today it is run by Ayatollah Khamenei. The only difference is the first name. We got the son, not the dad. We began the war, the Iranians had nuclear material. Today they have nuclear material. We began the war, the Strait of Hormuz was right next to Iran. And we end the war and the Strait of Hormuz is right next to Iran, and they understand that they can close it. So that means revealing to another country a strategic weakness is the same as losing a battle that creates a strategic weakness. And that's where the US is right now. So I think there's going to be very, very long-run consequences. Mistrust between the United States and the rest of the world. It was already at a low after the United States threatened to invade Canada and Greenland. And some people think those are funny and that they're a joke, but you ask a European what it was about, and they will tell you the threats to invade Greenland weren't very funny. And my brother lives in Canada, and he will tell you elbows up, threatening to invade Canada isn't very funny, and they're still not buying American wine, for instance. And we're going to see, I think, much greater spending on defense throughout the Middle East, possibly through other industrialized nations. A weakening of trust in the US defense umbrella, which of course then means if everyone's spending more money on arms and you want to be the supreme, you want military supremacy, you just made military supremacy more expensive. And so the long run fiscal consequences, the budgetary consequences, I think are very, very large. So, you know, I run a YouTube channel and a Substack called Platypus Economics, where I've done quite a bit of work sort of making the case to the American people that the cost of this war for the typical American family, overall for the country, will be measured in trillions of dollars, not billions. And for the typical American family will be measured in thousands or maybe tens of thousands of dollars.
The futures market is actually predicting higher interest rates than they were before the war now.
Yep.
How do you think the new president of the Federal Reserve, Kevin Warsh, will respond to that? You at one stage, I think, called him a sock puppet. But it turns out he's not actually like that, doesn't seem to be, does he?
So the big question, okay, so let me go back a step. So there was an old joke that the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board was the second most important person in the world. And it's one of those jokes that's only funny because it's true. And if the US were to be put in recession by the Federal Reserve chair, you bet folks in Australia would understand that. It would have implications for your quality of life too. The big question leading up to Warsh's first meeting was, had he struck a deal in private with the president? The president made it very clear what he wanted. The president was very clear he wanted the sock puppet. And during his testimony to the Senate before confirmation, Warsh had said some things that really made him sound like more of a political player than a serious central banker. So the question was, is he a sock puppet like so many of the Trump appointees are, or is he, Warsh had previously served on the Federal Reserve Board as a governor, sort of like a member of the Reserve Bank Board. And during that period, he'd not been a sock puppet at all. He'd been very strong-minded, but actually he was a hard money, anti-inflation hawk. And so, which is the opposite of what Trump wanted. And so the question is it the guy we saw between 2006 and 2011, hawkish Kevin, or is it sock puppet Kevin, the guy who'll say anything to get ahead? And Warsh, I think, tried to make it clear that he is going to be hawkish Kevin, which is literally the opposite of what Trump wants. And I think so far most folks are taking, you know, we don't have a ton of evidence on this, but it looks like that's the standard view on Wall Street now. So the good news coming out of that is at least the guy's not insane. The bad news is, yeah, but he's a little bit idiosyncratic.
Yeah, but so President Trump will probably start calling him a moron soon, like he did with Jerome Powell, who he also pointed.
It won't be long. And before that, he thought that Janet Yellen was too short. So, you know.
Well, she is very short.
She's also splendid. I love Janet.
She is great. I agree.
So.
The other thing we learned the other day is that Trump has been making tons of money from being a president.
Yeah.
And he was doing something like 80 stock trades a day during 2025, as well as hundreds of Truth Social posts. Now, you've described the Trump presidency as one that favors extraction over growth.
Yeah.
Which seems pretty apt, it seems to me. But is there an economic impact of what he's doing, apart from the kind of the moral impact?
Yes. Let me start in particular on where he's been making money. The stuff about the stock trades, I think most of the money involved in those trades is sufficiently small, it's unlikely to be a major factor. It's just utterly graceless that he has elected to do that. Now, what he's done instead, though, is he's got things like billion-dollar investments in crypto and in a range of other industries where he's essentially just been providing ways of people to buy him off. He's selling the presidency. The recent estimate is in the first year of his presidency, he made $2 billion. His 19-year-old son, Barron Trump, is worth $150 million. Either that guy's a genius or he's trading off something that I think really belongs to the American people, which is the power of the presidency. And what this raises in the short term is actually quite terrifying prospect, which is if you're making money at $2 billion a year, that's $8 billion over a presidential cycle. Do you know how much it costs to buy a presidency? Less than that. Total, as much money as there is in American politics, the Republican Party only spent $2 billion getting Trump elected. And so that means if you're a wily billionaire, you can afford to buy the presidency and it's profitable. And that's terrifying for the future of democracy. And I do think that that ought to be a very, very urgent call for Australians to think about the role of money in our own politics.
In fact, the Supreme Court's made it easier for billionaires to buy political office, haven't they?
Unquestionably, yes. And so Elon Musk put $250 million into the last presidential election. And the thing is, Elon Musk is now worth $1 trillion, which means having bought one American election, he can still afford 3,999 others, which, again, you just want to hope that he doesn't suddenly become interested in Australia, or we want to have a set of rules in place such that were he to become deeply interested in Australia, his money wouldn't be able to buy power.
Thanks for joining us, Justin. It's been great talking to you.
Great pleasure, mate.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business on the ABC Business Daily feed every Friday. And so you don't miss out, make sure you follow ABC Business Daily to find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Dan Ziffer and the ABC Business Daily team will be back in the feed on Monday.